Hello and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yes, it's time for a very Christmassy edition of Fictional Foods, because until you suggested this, I totally forgot that Christmas does play a big role in The Lion, the Witch, and Wardrobe specifically.
Yes, yes, because of circumstances, evil plotting circumstances. Ooh. When you catch up with the events of Narnia in that first book, a witch has made it so that it is always winter and never Christmas.
Terrible, just terrible.
Right, the worst.
The worst. I went through a very, very brief but very intense. Chronicles of Narnia period. I wrote a fan fiction.
Oh, wow.
It was a whole thing. And it, for everybody who's written in asking for my fan fiction, thank you. One, I'm flattered. two, I'm ashamed to say this, but I was ashamed and deleted all of my fan fiction.
Oh.
So they don't exist anymore.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I wish I could find it. Like, I can't find any record. I'm sure they would be really funny to me now.
Sure. You know. It would probably be very charming.
I think they would be cute to read.
Yeah.
The ones I'm writing now, maybe I'll get the courage to post, but probably not. But anyway, my Chronicles of Narnia fan fiction, which was a severe angst thing, because that's what I always did, is gone.
Dang.
Yeah, yeah, lost a time. It's... Since then, because that was probably high school. It was like when the movies were coming out for
me. Oh, okay, okay. Uh-huh.
Like, I'd read the books and already, but when the movies came out, I just went through this really intense thing.
Sure.
But since then, I don't think I've read or rewatched them. So when I was doing the research for this, I was surprised at how much I remember. Certainly, there were things like the Christmas thing that I had forgotten, but, like, it all came back to me when I was researching.
Sure.
But And just by the way, if you're an adult and you're looking for something to definitely disturb you, I'll say definitely. I wrote probably here, but I think definitely. I recommend Neil Gaiman's The Problem of Susan.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really excellent piece exploring. And we'll talk about it a little bit. Some of the perhaps not so kind to ladies themes that occur within these books. I love that this was your high school, that you were deeply into it in high school. I went through my deeply into Narnia when I was maybe like 7. So like I didn't know what fan fiction was. We had like Prodigy at the time, y'all.
What is Prodigy? Not the band, I am assuming.
It was an internet program.
Internet connective program, I see.
Yes. Or such as the internet was at the time. I didn't know anything about fan fiction then. But I was so into the Chronicles of Narnia from the ages of maybe like 6 or 7 to maybe like 12 or 13, I want to say, like to the point that like I think I reread the books like at least once a year, and I would just like read like one of them over and over and over again, because that's a thing that I did when I was a kid. Partially because I was like I was so into language and like story building and just really wanted to take things apart and see why they made me feel things and how. And how those little linguistic turns worked to make like funny things funny or dramatic things dramatic. And so I had these very favorite books that I would just go through like that. And I was also really into, there was like an animated movie that had been out, and I think I might have had The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe like on audiobook or something. Cause I reread maybe like 4 of the books, like, I don't know, like today. And it was funny to me how much of it was still in my ear, like how many of the lines that had been taken directly from the book were still in my ear from a particular performer of those lines. So, yeah, weird how stuff like that sticks with you. I'm like, I can't remember my own phone number sometimes. Is that because I've got this entire speech from Aslan in my head? That's great. That's just great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the language in it is certainly, a lot of it's really memorable. And I did that same thing when I was a kid, too. Although I did it, and I still do this, where I'll consume something over and over again because I live in fear, a ridiculous fear that one day it will be gone. Oh. And I'll have to rely on my memory alone.
Huh.
So I, wow. Yeah.
That's a very, like, apocalyptic, like, take on storytelling. I like it.
I feel like it's that Twilight Zone episode, you know? Like, I had more time. That's really stuck with me. And I was like, what if I can't watch Star Wars? I must watch it 500 times, and then it will be in my head.
Yeah, well, at this point, I fully believe in you to, like, perform the entirety of Star Wars. So.
I can. The original trilogy. Oh, gosh. The play is forthcoming. Also forthcoming, our Alice in Wonderland long-teased Alice in Wonderland episode. We will get to it. I'm excited
really
to get to it.
Yes, yes.
But today we're talking about Narnia, so let's get to our question.
Yes!
Well, Chronicles of Narnia. What is it?
Narnia is a fictional land first written about in the children's novel series The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. There are 7 books in the series, and they tell the tale of Narnia from the very beginning to the very end, though out of order if you read them in the order that they were published, which you should. And people on the internet still argue about this.
They
do. And I think C.S. Lewis disagreed with me, but I disagree with him.
So there. I'll back you up on this.
Who likes a story that starts at the beginning? Come on.
Ridiculous.
You don't have any context for the important things that are happening unless you read it in the order that they were published.
Yes. I did read them. I read them, quote, out of order. But then I read them a lot, so it just all got mixed together.
Well, those books are The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, The Silver Chair, The Horse and His Boy, The Magician's Nephew, and The Last Battle. They were published starting in 1950, running through 1956, so very quickly. Although they are pretty short. They're kids' books. They're only a couple hundred pages each. They've been adapted since then into radio plays, the aforementioned animated film in 1979, a live-action television series on BBC in 88, and a series of live-action films starting in 2005. Meanwhile, their author, C.S. Lewis, was born in 1898, Clive Staples Lewis, in Belfast, Ireland, but lived most of his life in Oxford, England, where he studied and taught. He was a soldier in the British Army in World War I, was friends with contemporaries like J.R.R. Tolkien, and a fellow member of the Inklings Literary Circle there in Oxford. He was influenced as a young man by Norse mythology and like Wagner's operas, and would go on to study a lot of medieval and Renaissance literature as an adult. And you can see those influences on his storytelling and also in the foods that he portrays in these stories, which do take on, in the case of Narnia, some elements of like Arthurian legend.
Mm-hmm.
And although Lewis lost his faith for a decade or so in his youth, he was very dedicated to Christianity throughout his adult life, and he wrote and spoke extensively about spirituality and faith and study and truth and the nature of good and evil and how we humans relate to it. There are a lot of very overt elements of Christian mythology and thought and discussion that happen within the Chronicles of Narnia. But C.S. Lewis wants you to know that it is not an allegory. He would get actually pretty salty with interviewers about this. He would be like, do you know what allegory means? Because I come out and say it. I say that Aslan is Jesus. It's not an allegory anymore. That's just a thought experiment. Like... comma, heckin' smarto. Like, I... which is kind of my favorite. So yeah, it's a fable, not an allegory. But hey, this is a food show.
Yes.
And like in many fantasy series, because these are a fantasy series, the food that is portrayed in them is a connection point to reality, like a way of helping ground the reader, and also a way of coding in some of those metaphors and like emotional tent poles into the stories.
Right. Yeah, and apparently C.S. Lewis's mother frequently turned to Mrs. Isabella Beaton's The Book of Household Management. See our past episode on her for that.
Yeah.
So he grew up before mass-produced food, when the butcher or milkman would deliver food to your door, when many people still grew their own vegetables, and many took pride in their product and sharing it with others. And these are things that we see reflected in these stories, and also the flip side of that, of what happens when you don't respect food and what's mm-hmm. behind it and the people behind it. Different realms have different cuisines and specialize in different things, and several of the talking animals that are in these books.
Because there are talking animals.
Yes.
There are regular animals, and then there are animals that talk. There's both.
There is both. Many of the talking animals, we know at least, eat a diet of foods associated with those animals, like bears eating honey, squirrels eating nuts, things like that.
Yeah. Tree people eat all kinds of different soils, that no matter how delicious they look, humans shouldn't probably eat them. Centaurs eat just a lot. I mean, like, they have a man's stomach and they have a horse stomach and both want to eat. And so therefore it is very serious to invite one over for the weekend.
Oh, geez, I can imagine.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's this huge emphasis on not just the eating of, but the preparation of food and of meals, and of meals being pleasant and communal and humanizing and uplifting, and like the first thing that Aslan asks the very first king of Narnia, whose name is Frank. Who's a cabbie, King uh-huh. Frank. Because Frank is like, well, like, can I really be king? Like, I'm not very, like, edumacated. And Aslan is like, well, can you use a spade and a plow to raise food out of the earth? And Frank is like, yeah, probably. I was sort of raised in that. I guess I can. I'm paraphrasing. He was a lot more Cockney, and I'm not up to the accent today.
No, yeah, that's a tricky one.
yeah. It's also important to recognize the influence of the world wars on these books, because like the first book is set starting in London and moving out to the British countryside during the Blitz during World War II. So the kids who are escaping the Blitz are probably well familiar with rationing. And I think that really helps put in perspective some of especially that first book's emphasis on these simple pleasures, on you know, just like how heckin' good candy can be. Like, oh my gosh, candy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also just like a lot of like rereading them now. And we rewatched The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe live-action film last Christmas, I think, me and my roommates. And we were all kind of like, oh, there's a whole war. There's a whole battle in here. This is a children's movie, and they are just smacking yep. swords at each other, and that is a lot. I had forgotten. Mm-hmm. So that happens. And as I was going through the, like, four books that I read today, like, there's a battle. There's a war in all of them.
Yeah.
It's like kind of upsettingly violent. But I guess also I was struck by how like honest it is about fighting being scary and unpleasant. Which I feel like is a thing that you don't always get from some of these stories. Also, they make a big thing out of cleaning your sword. Aslan is like, Peter, clean your sword after you stab someone with it.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that I've taken with me this whole time It has never left. And so whenever, not that I have to clean my sword a lot,
I was about to ask some questions.
Oh, geez. No, just whenever in a movie, like someone goes all stabby-stabby and then immediately sheathes their sword without doing anything. I'm like, you're going to rust.
Yeah, you don't want that.
No.
You don't want that.
Those are expensive.
Mm. I'm glad that's what you took to carry that from these books.
You know, had to be something. Had to be something.
Had to be something. And food, it does serve all kinds of purposes in these books. There's temptation in the form of the magic apple and the Turkish delights. There's fortification, a source of camaraderie, a source of comfort, a source of spirituality, a source of healing. From the betrayal necessitated by candy, or I guess by the temptation, the candy provided. It was a very tempting candy. Yeah. To the food that connects the children in Narnia to their home. Tea frequently appears, and it itself can function as a way to warm up from the cold, to form connections with others, or to show others that you care. After the devastating betrayal of their brother, the other three Pevensey children, and so this is, well, the plot can get complicated, but in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, they spend a cold, dark, and lonely winter morning that only brightens with the arrival of Father Christmas and his pot of warm tea, and also, like, weapons and stuff. But the tea, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, don't forget, definitely, it was piping hot tea plus weapons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tea first, weapons later.
Tea first, weapons later. Very English, yes. Similarly, a group of Narnians in that book that the White Witch catches at breakfast are celebrating with a plum pudding. Very English.
Yes. And speaking of, there are a lot of British things like that to my American mind. Growing up, reading a lot of British fiction feel fantastical or quaint. I know they're not,
sure.
But to me, they feel that way. Like meat pasties or pasties and teas and cheese and figs, Turkish delight, quote, cakes of oat and meal, snipe. Not that those things aren't in the U.S., but to me, they were fairly rare or just kind of sounded like, huh, what is that? Outside of Kraft American cheese.
What? That shows up somewhere? What?
What? No, I'm just saying, like, I knew cheese, but believe it or not, growing up as a kid,
okay.
I really only had that kind of cheese. So, like, hearing about, like, this meal
like
of cheese.
Like a wheel of cheese, sure.
Yeah, exactly. And there's an emphasis on breakfast, on afternoon tea, things like
that. Yeah. There's a character in one of the later books whose catchphrase is crabs and crumpets.
Oh, I love that.
That's I great. Know, right? Oh, great. Narnia is also very idyllic. Even the streams there, perhaps only if you're hanging out with Aslan, are the best. Cleanest water, the coldest, best drink you've ever had.
Yeah. As far as numbers, there's one that we wanted to include because there is at least one cookbook.
Right.
The official Narnia cookbook, Foods from C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia by Douglas Gresham and illustrated by Pauline Baynes in 1998. And it was split up into basic meal categories. So breakfast, lunch, afternoon tea, dinner, dessert, and drinks. And it starts with the safety foreword.
Oh.
Yeah, like it's mostly basic safety tips for kids.
Uh-huh.
But still, I was like, wow, the kitchen is dangerous. There should be more safety forwards.
Yeah.
And in the spirit of Narnia, the recipes use modern appliances as sparingly as possible.
Oh,
so they're
okay.
Much more like, don't use that fancy modern tech.
Mix it with your hands, with your hands.
With your hands. But we did want to spotlight some specific food and drink things.
Yes, we did. But first, we wanted to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with the Turkish delight.
Yep.
Yeah. Because this is the first thing I think of. When I would think of food in Chronicles of Narnia, and I would imagine it's the same for a lot of people listening.
Yeah.
Future episode, but if you're not aware, a Turkish delight is usually a starch and powdered sugar confection typically flavored with rose water or sometimes lemon, sometimes both.
Yeah. It can come in a lot of different formats. It can be a little bit more like marshmallowy, or it can be a little bit more jelly-like. I personally prefer the jelly rose water ones, but it can also have like nuts in there or bits of dried fruit. Lots of different formats.
Yes. And it is the sweet that the White Witch, if you somehow don't know these books or this story and you haven't deduced it yet, is the villain, the White Witch, offers to Edmund Pevensey that facilitates his betrayal of his siblings and of Narnia. It was his favorite, so couldn't really resist. She gives him an entire box along with a, quote, hot drink.
From the book, it was something he had never tasted before, very sweet and foamy and creamy.
And these both seemed as though they had an addictive quality, and Edmund often felt sick after eating them.
Yeah, they were enchanted, so that, quote, anyone who had once tasted it would want more and more of it, and would even, if they were allowed, go on eating it till they killed themselves.
Oosh.
Book for children. And he you know, like, as one does when they eat several pounds of candy, which he does eat. She gives him this box that contains several pounds of this candy, and he just eats it because it's enchanted. He still wants more of it. He's still thinking about it later. Later when they run into a pair of friendly beavers. Mr. Beaver says, he had the look of one who has been with the witch and eaten her food. You can always tell them if you've lived long in Narnia. Something about their eyes.
Yeesh. Later, when Edmund is at the White Witch's castle, despite her promises of Turkish delight, all he gets is stale bread and water.
Yep.
False promises.
Yep. She had already lured him in. Didn't need to waste the magic on him again. He was already there. But take this in contrast to this kind of empty calorie sweet that Edmund gets. Take that in contrast with the first meal that Lucy eats in Narnia, because she runs into a very kind fawn by the name of Mr. Tumnus. And he serves her this humble but delicious tea of a nice brown egg, lightly boiled for each of them, and then sardines on toast, and then buttered toast, and then toast with honey, and then a sugar-topped cake. Just so plain but nice sounding.
Yeah.
At least you got some protein in there. Always eat some protein, you know. And then again, when all the kids finally get into Narnia and catch up with the aforementioned beavers, they have this wonderful sounding dinner. There's pan-fried trout and boiled potatoes with as much butter as they wanted, and bread and a huge jug of beer for Mr. Beaver, milk for the kids. If you'll indulge me in quoting again, the book says, and all the children thought, and I agree with them, that there's nothing to beat good freshwater fish if you eat it when it's been alive half an hour ago and has come out of the pan half a minute ago.
Mm. Yeah, they just sound so simple but so delicious, these things.
Right? Ugh.
Yeah. And then there's Mr. and Mrs. Beaver's, quote, great and glorious sticky marmalade roll, steaming hot. I guess it's Mrs. Beaver's. Let me give credit where credit is due.
Yeah, probably.
This was something she was really proud of making and to share with people. She wanted to share it with people. And this is a big scene when all the children are in Narnia. It's cold, and the beavers take them in and tell them all about the evil besieging Narnia. And these rolls were a fortifying, comforting thing during that conversation, and like during that cold.
Yeah. They had been hungry and lost, and they didn't know what they were going to do or who was a friend or a foe. And they get brought into the home that the beavers have made within the dam. And like the book mentions that the beavers have like onions and hams hanging up in there, like as this way of explaining that it's plain but comfortable. A few pages later, even as they are fleeing for their lives, Mrs. Beaver makes sure to pack a parcel of food for each of them. And later remarks, what a mercy I thought of bringing the bread knife. Not for stabby purposes. Oh, geez, right. It's for bread. It's for bread. It's when Father Christmas shows up, there's bread. Yes. But notably, Edmund cannot enjoy any of this simple, beautiful feast because he's thinking all the while about that Turkish delight. And the book says, there's nothing that spoils the taste of good, ordinary food half so much as the memory of bad, magic food.
Ooh, sounds about, you know, like a commentary on mass production and that kind of stuff.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. And related to that, actually, a category of food within the books is hunt your own food. Yeah. I think at least once per book, the heroes wind up fishing or hunting birds. One of the characters that some of the other kids meet in another book, a puddle glum, who is a marsh wiggle. Which is a tall, kind of froggy sort of looking mm-hmm. person. He says very seriously that other marsh wiggles have told him that he is way too jolly and that he has to learn that life is not all fricasseed frogs and eel pie.
So much wisdom.
And it's
yes.
But yeah, he catches eels for the kids and makes them stew right there. And it seems tasty. Though, speaking of catching and eating things. There is some cannibalism in these books.
What? What? I don't remember cannibalism. Wow.
There is at least one point in which a group of rather nasty giants eat a talking stag. And for a Narnian, you know, I mean, like if an animal is a talking animal, that's a self-conscious creature. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be like eating a person. So that's bad.
Same
giants are totally planning on cooking some human pies and doing something to get the string out of that marsh wiggle. They find a cookbook. That's very very to serve man. It's got this entry, and this is when they know the jig is up. It says, man, this elegant little biped has long been valued as a delicacy. It forms a traditional part of the autumn feast and is served between the fish and the joint.
Hey, at least it's a valued delicacy.
That's looking on the bright side.
Also, it says man. It doesn't say woman, so wipe my hand of that.
Oh, they were totally going to eat the little girl, too.
Well, that's... Their cookbook is wrong, then. Their recipe needs to be updated. It's feminism is now, and I won't stand for it. There are also a lot of feasts in these books.
There are.
Yes. In The Silver Chair, there's a feast at Cair Paravel with, quote, soups that would make your mouth water to think of, and then fish, venison, peacock pies, ices, jellies, fruits, nuts, wines, and fruit drinks.
Dinner in the giant castle before the whole cannibalism thing crops up. There's cockleiky soup, hot roast turkey, steamed pudding, roast chestnuts, and as much fruit as you could eat.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. in yet another castle, there's a beautiful sounding meal of pigeon pie, cold ham, salad, and honey cakes, which interestingly, in scare quotes, are described as being from some barbarous land in the far south. Cool. Cool. We're going to come back to that one.
Yes.
As opposed to these kind of within castles, kind of regal affair things, there are a lot more words and language and flowery stuff spent on describing more simple meals. When the kids get back from this kind of horrifying adventure into Narnia proper, it involves a breakfast that's described thusly.
Sausages and more and more and more sausages. And not wretched sausages, half full of bread and soya bean either, but real meaty, spicy ones, fat and piping hot and burst and just the tiniest bit burned. And great mugs of frothy chocolate and roast potatoes and roast chestnuts and baked apples with raisins stuck in where the cores had been, and then ices just to freshen you up after all the hot things.
Ah, it does sound good.
Gosh, it does, doesn't it?
Yes.
Ooh. Huh. Mm-hmm. And then there was one I wanted to mention. There is this like kingliest feast of all kings, set at Ramandu's island at Aslan's table. And this reminded me so much of when we've done episodes that involve these medieval feasts. Because it was described as having not just turkeys and geese, but peacocks and boar's heads, venison and pies shaped like animals and ships, ice puddings, lobsters, salmon, nuts, grapes and pineapples and peaches and pomegranates and melons and tomatoes. That one threw me.
Yeah.
And so many kinds of wine.
Yes. Wine.
Wine on wine on wine.
Yeah. And then there's also like a toffee tree.
Yeah. Why not?
Kind of. In the magician's nephew, all of this life energy was flowing through this new world of Narnia. So when two characters, Polly Plummer and Diggory Kirk, buried a piece of toffee in the ground, it grew into this tree that produced fruits, I think, that resembled dates but tasted like toffee.
There are a lot of magical trees that go on in that book.
Yes. Speaking of, let's talk about apples. Yes. In keeping with the religious symbolism in these books, apples are common throughout, whether the magic apple that heals when eaten legally, keyword, and causes evil when not, or the apples that kept the Pevensies from starving in Prince Caspian. The silver apple tree species grew from Narnia's Garden of Youth, yielding unearthly, beautiful silver apples. But more than that, there was this irresistible scent to them. Quote, as if there was a window in the room that opened on heaven. Yeah. Eating the apples produced different outcomes based on whether or not they were eaten in the right time and place. When eaten unlawfully, the juice left a stain on the mouth, caused powers to develop in a way against your desire. It sounds like when you make the wish, and of course the wish goes terribly wrong. The lawbreaker would forever be disgusted by the smell of these apples to prevent, you know, further breaking of eating the law against eating these apples. While Jadis, or the White Witch, became the White Witch, got what she wanted, she could no longer get anywhere near the Tree of Protection, and she sentenced herself to an eternity of misery. And there were these four types of apple trees that all sort of begat each other. So first, there was the Tree of Youth. This grew in the Garden of Youth all the way back to the beginning, Narnia's year one. Both Diggory Kirk and Jadis took an apple from the tree, though it was guarded by a phoenix. But Diggory gave his apple to Aslan, and it grew into the Tree of Protection, while Jadis devoured hers to gain unending strength and immortality. Diggory was rewarded with an apple for his mother because he did the right thing and she was sick. So
yeah, got to go heal her with the, yeah.
Exactly. So that brings us to the Tree of Protection, which grew from an apple from the Tree of Life that Diggory took. And this kept evil at bay in Narnia for almost 900 years before its death. Before that happened, Diggory took a fruit from it in hopes of healing, yes, his dying mother. When the Tree of Protection died, due to her immortality, Jadis was able to take control of Narnia and reign for 100 years, always winter, never Christmas. And then that brings us to the wardrobe tree. And this is the tree that, yes, went on to be the wood for the wardrobe and the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe. And it was grown from a leftover core of the magic apple that Diggory's mother ate. So it was planted on Earth. And it sometimes would move without winds. And the sap was always pure as Narnia. And lastly, the Tree of Knowledge, found in Aslan's country, where it flourishes. Fruit in general acts as something in these books to survive on, but also at feast as a luxury to indulge in, particularly in the amount and variety offered. A lot of the food in these books functions similarly in a similar way. Fruits do.
The descriptions of quantities of food in general, like whenever it was like, oh man, this feast was super cool, it had so much food, like it had as much butter as you want, like you could use as much as you want, like it's just such a like very post-wartime mentality to me, that I find really, really fascinating. In Aslan's country, as Aslan being, again, the parallel to Jesus, there's all manner of amazing food. Beyond description. But let me describe it for a minute. which is one of my very favorite literary tropes. But non-believers can't enjoy it.
Oh, it's like Hook.
There's this one a fruit tree, and the narrator says, "Unfortunately, no one can describe a taste, but compared with those fruits, the freshest grapefruit was dull and the juiciest orange was dry, and the most melting pear was hard and woody, and the sweetest wild strawberry was sour, and there were no seeds or stones and no wasps. If you had once eaten that fruit, all the nicest things in this world would taste like medicines after it. But I can't describe it. You can't find out what it is like unless you can get to that country and taste it for yourself."
Oh, that is fun. I love that. It's like a paragraph of description.
That's my favorite thing about H.P. Lovecraft. Is like, oh, it's beyond description. Seven paragraphs later, I'm like, cool. Cool. Uh-huh. You're racist. Other magical stuff in the Chronicles of Narnia. There's Lucy's cordial, which is given to her by Father Christmas, which is a healing potion that is made of the juice of one of the fire flowers that grow in the mountains of the sun.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that.
And there's also, in a world far beneath the surface of Narnia, below even the deepest mines, there's a land called Bizzim, where gems live and grow like fruits. One of the creatures, one of the kind of goblin things from down there says, "I'll pick you bunches of rubies that you can eat and squeeze you a cupful of diamond juice. You won't care much about fingering the cold dead treasures of your shallow mines once you've tasted the live ones of Bizzim."
Oh.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah, I spent a really dedicated, like, ever pretending that pomegranate bits were rubies from Bizzim. Yeah. There's also the sweet seawater of the last sea at the end of the world that's like drinkable light.
Ooh. Ah, I love it. Well, there's also wine, and there's beer. And alongside tea, these beverages show up at joyous occasions, both big and small, which may just include surviving or escaping your not so great adoptive dad.
You know, why not?
Why not?
When Edmund is rescued, wine is given to him as a restorative. The aforementioned Puddleglum gets kind of drunk on some kind of liquor from a black bottle, never really specified what. And there's like kind of a lot of drinking in these books. It's always, I mean, aside from that one drunk Marshwiggle, it's always kind of like nice drinking, I guess. But up to the point that like Bacchus and Silenus are discussed and also show up at one point.
Yeah.
With like a kind of scary dance of wood nymphs and stuff. It says that when they do show up, the streams would run with wine instead of water, and the whole forest would give itself up to jollification for weeks on end. The feast, when they hang out, there's like a bonfire, there's roasted meats, there's wheat cakes and oat cakes and honey and sugars and creams and many different colors, all kinds of fruit, varieties of wine, again, every color of wine. Yeah. Yellow and green and yellowish green and greenish yellow.
Yes. Chartreuse, I'm sure.
Sure. And I guess that's not necessarily the best transition, but it's a transition into saying, hey, these books have some problematic stuff in them here and there.
Mm-hmm.
They were written in the 50s, you know, by a dude who was born in 1898. And so looking at many things from the past with the lens of our modern perspective can shine lights on things that perhaps were not thought of then.
Yes.
But I mean, just in, okay, like the biggest thing is like really ugly racism towards a group of neighboring countrymen called the Kalermen, who are clearly meant to be Arab Muslims, not at all nicely portrayed. And like the city is called out, their city is called out for smelling unpleasantly of garlic and onions. Even like a really nice meal there is described as like, it was a fine meal after the Kalermen fashion. I don't know whether you would have liked it or not. And I'm like, oh, that's heckin' shady.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's not cool. There's some other stuff in there that's kind of weird. You know, like just these very, and I'm struggling between, because dude was originally from Ireland, but he had lived in England so long, and you know, was I'm trying to decide whether to use the word British or English, and I think that British does really apply, because you know you've got like Aslan as this lion, like the lion, the great lion, the king of beasts, which A is like zoologically inaccurate.
Yeah.
Like lions aren't really that regal. They mostly steal stuff from other more hardworking animals that bother to make a kill. But also I was reading into some of the theory about this, and some Christian critics have written a lot about disagreeing with the portrayal of Jesus as this hyper powerful and often militant creature. And apparently Lewis subscribed to what's called muscular Christianity, which has all of these ideals of masculinity and athleticism that were part of that. Tying into that, there are at least lady female heroines.
Yes.
In every book.
Uh-huh.
That's cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But frequently, yeah, just portrayals of masculinity and femininity are skewed. Those witches are witches. And the problem of Susan, you know, which to summarize is that Susan by the end of the series is denied entry into Aslan's country, into heaven, essentially, because she is, and I quote, interested in nylons and lipstick and invitations.
Yeah. Yeah. It's even as a kid, Lauren and I were discussing this beforehand. I was like, that what?
That doesn't seem chill.
Like that doesn't seem right.
And it's not, I mean, you can make an argument, I can make an argument that it's not just that. It's that, you know, she gave up her belief in and relationship with Aslan for these other things. But, you know, critics have posited that it's because she actually just got interested in, like, maybe having sex, and that yeah. C.S. Lewis was anti that thing. I didn't know the dude, you know, I can't tell you. But also I just want to point out, this is unrelated, but I think it's fairly heckin' odd that this whole kingdom of Narnia is destined to be given over to the rule of four human randos from another planet who just like show up and our children?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess it's sort of the thing with, you know, God created people. And then was like, here you go. That's exactly how it went.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. Uh-huh. Yeah, it rings as very odd to me.
Yes.
And this is also part of why I've mentioned this on the show before. I am so very fond of the series The Magicians, mm-hmm. because within the series, there's this kind of parody Narnia that the heroes find out is a real place, and they go there and they're like, oh, this is actually sort of screwed. Why is this like this?
Mm-hmm.
Does a lot of commentary about that. His Dark Materials also does a bit of commentary, although Philip Pullman was more directly referencing Lewis's space trilogy with that one. So it's, you know, either way, interesting to pull apart, to think about, to consider.
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I will say, apparently J.R.R. ribbed C.S. Lewis for the world of Narnia being kind of like hastily and haphazardly stitched together from all of these like mythological scraps. He was sort of like, oh, you didn't invent 8 languages?
What's
a whole,
wrong with you?
A whole biosphere for your world? Okay. Okay.
I see you.
Mm-hmm. and I wanted to close considering, because I put all this at the end and I don't want to end it on like a super down note, because clearly, if it's not clear, I just read 4 of these basically for fun over the past 24 hours. Like, I am still very charmed by these books and by a lot of the ideas and the ideals in them. I think that they're very sweet for the most part. Aside from that really tremendous racism, maybe just skip The Horse and His Boy, y'all. Maybe just skip that one. But I read this really nice sentiment in the Houston Chronicle from writer Kyrie O'Connor. Regarding what you might tell your kids about this sort of thing, if you're talking with them about this sort of thing. And she said, the man who wrote this book wrote a lot of great stories, but they were great when they were complicated and magical, when his imagination took him into places and stories that were close to his heart. In his time, people thought it was amusing to make fun of other cultures. We don't. Read the stories, ask questions, and remember that the person who wrote this story was altogether too human.
Yeah. Yeah. Always good to look critically at the entertainment you consume. You
yes.
can still consume it and you can still like it, but ask those questions.
And right. Talk about it. Be like, man, that part sucked.
Yeah, and here's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been a very fun Christmassy fictional foods look at Narnia. Oh, we would love if you listeners have Narnia recipes. That'd be amazing.
Oh my gosh. Yes, yes. I mean, I've got a box of Turkish Delight downstairs, but I bought it.
Ooh.
I didn't make it out of magic or make it myself, neither.
I mean, speaking of like not making your own world, Lauren. and also speaking of, we do have some listener mail for you.
Oh, yeah, we do. But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
Listener
It was like a sword thing, and then it was snow. There was a lot going on.
I thought it was like a banner, like a, you know.
Yeah, I could go for that too.
Okay.
You know, it's up for interpretation. Emily wrote, I just finished listening to your episode about Carob, and I wholeheartedly agree on the rant about food alternatives.
Hmm.
It's like chocolate. It isn't hecking chocolate. That's my Lauren impression. I just had to write to share my experience on going on a mostly whole food, plant-based lifestyle. My husband and I have been doing it for over a year, and a big motivator to stick with it was that it was the only kind of food I could eat while pregnant. Thanks, nausea. It's been a year full of some very good foods and some very pathetic dishes trying to pass off as food. When I mentioned it to friends, I get a lot of questions. And my number one piece of advice is, don't expect to make replacement foods and have it taste just as good as the real deal. Bless you if you are good with the nooch-ridden vegan mac and cheese. But for those of us who do love cheese, it is an insult to our taste buds. So please go throw it in the compost heap where it belongs. I tried making chili recipes that typically would include meat as meatless dishes, and it tasted so empty. Just a few examples of what I'm talking about. Vegan and non-restrictive dishes are not tit for tat. Number two piece of advice, explore, try new things, be adventurous, get outside the comfort zone, make crappy dishes. You'll learn how to make food your very good friend. You might be wondering why we eat, quote, mostly whole food plant-based. Well, the biggest thing is we are weak. Like when Thanksgiving came around, I made and we cheerfully ate very quickly two maple pumpkin cheesecakes, my favorite Thanksgiving treat. In consolation, I tell myself that I eat well so I don't feel too guilty when I don't. Well, I still feel guilty. But I also love that freaking cheesecake.
That is what it is all about. You know, treats are important. Treats are really important.
They are. And good for you. And I think this is great advice.
Like, yeah.
All around solid, solid advice. Be adventurous.
Yeah. Right. Make crappy dishes.
Yeah. And learn from them.
Learn from them. Yes. Mm-hmm. Always learn. Always be learning.
Always.
Neve wrote, after listening to your pastrami episode, I wanted to tell you about the spiced beef, which is one of the traditional Christmas dishes in my home city, Cork, Ireland, which is related to, but not the same, as corned beef or pastrami. It's salt beef that's been cured in a spice blend for 2 to 3 months, salted and cured, but not smoked. Butchers will have their own secret house recipe, which will include some secret combination of spices such as cloves, galangal, I never know how to say that. Moving on. Ginger, mace, allspice, juniper, cinnamon, or peppercorns. For most of the year, it's hard to find outside Cork City, but is more widely available at Christmas time. Our family has turkey, ham, and spiced beef every year for Christmas dinner, making sure to have some left over for sandwiches the next day. To give you an idea of its popularity, one of the traditional craft butchers in Cork sells over 6 tons of spiced beef over the Christmas period. And this is in a city smaller than Augusta, Georgia.
Wow.
That's quite a bit.
That's impressive. Also, gosh. I want it.
Yes.
I want it.
Gosh. Huh. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, okay, dang. Indeed. Maybe one day. Maybe yeah. one day.
Yeah.
Well, in the meantime, thanks to both of those listeners for writing. If you'd like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
You can also get in touch with us on social media. Our handles on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram are @saverpod, and we do hope to hear from you. If you are celebrating a holiday right now, or if you're not, I hope that you are having a really beautiful one. We all do. It's not just me. That would be a schmucky thing to say. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.